is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, May 6, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio just north of New York City. You know, today we'll be talking with Atlanta Braves general manager Alex Anthopoulos, who joins in on the storytelling about the blockbuster deals he made to get a team back to the postseason for the first time in more than two decades, the addition of an MVP and a Cy Young Award winner. And how he wound up sitting on a park bench on the shore of Lake Ontario is all that was going along. But Taylor, before we get to that, I want to ask you, how are you handling haircuts? Okay. this has become an issue in my house in the last 24 hours.
I think you are just a small piece of the ongoing haircut crisis around the nation. I'm prone to let my hair grow a little bit longer than most people, but I really think I'm just going to let it fly until this is all over. Same thing with my beard. I might, you know, trim around the edges a little bit, but really, you know, as long as this goes, that's how long my hair is going to be. How did it go in your household? How are you handling it?
See, here's the thing. The big complicating factor is that I'm on TV usually one to four times a week.
Right.
So I couldn't let it just go completely bad. So I got a pair of clippers, right? I ordered for the some clippers with which my hair could be cut. But my wife is refusing to do it because she's afraid of making a mistake that will be broadcast all over the, you know, the country. My son, I don't think has any interest in doing that at 15. And I don't know if I necessarily trust him. Like if I take away his phone on a given day and then I hand him the hair clippers, what could happen with that? My daughter, who I just got back from college over the weekend, she's not really excited about it. But I tried 2 weeks ago, the first time I used the clippers, my son and my wife were very surprised at what an effective job I did. I'm like, well, you know what? I've been watching people give me haircuts for a lot of years, so I kind of know how they do it. Well, yesterday I went in for the second time, and I forgot to put on that guard that measures how Oh, my God. And I cut like this swath on the left side of my head. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And so I went through like four different rounds of trying to get it back. And I know this, you know, if the podcast thing doesn't work out today, I could certainly apply to go to the Marines with the haircut that I have now.
Wow. I think the world needs to see that. No. What about when you're going on TV next?
Well, I'm going on TV tomorrow morning. They asked me to be part of the KBO broadcast. It starts at 5:30 on Thursday morning. I'm going to be on it about 6:15. I tried to clean up my son, when he came down and saw my hair for the first time, he burst out laughing.
Oh, no.
Because of all the strands of hair that were left around the back. And of course, I'm like, can one of you please help me? No. So I was left to my own devices. Today, I think I cleaned it up enough where I wouldn't be confused with a dictator from Korea, and I think I'm doing okay, you know?
Okay. Well, I'm excited. You know what? I might get up tomorrow morning just to see the job you've done on television, but I'm actually a little bit concerned that none of your family members were willing to help you, like not even a little bit, like not even to clean up in the back. That's a little bit distressing.
Well, it's because first off, my hair is really curly and they don't want to make a mistake. That's what happened with my mom, too. She wouldn't cut my hair.
Oh, wow.
Because it was just too curly. And she was like, that's a disaster. Anyway, I'm going to ask Alex Anthopoulos about that. Before we get to that and to Paul Ambichides, a couple of notes for you. Hall of Fame pitcher Pedro Martinez and a coalition of over 40 current and retired Major League players have united to launch the Step Up to the Plate Fund to support coronavirus relief efforts in the Dominican Republic. The quote from Pedro Martinez in a video call with ESPN, Dominican Republic has been my home, and right now it truly needs your help. Being supported in this effort by so many of my fellow players is an honor. These are people without the most basic needs, and we are blessed to be in a position to help, and it is our duty to do so. Agent Scott Boras penned an op-ed for the New York Times, published today with the title, We Have to Bring Baseball Back. As the title suggests, Boras writes in favor of Major League Baseball resuming sooner rather than later. But this is me talking. The devil is in the details, and one of the questions I have, if it goes badly, if some older staffer is infected and God forbid passes away, who will take responsibility for that decision to open the sport? All right. Check out the latest episode of the Adam Schefter podcast. Adam talks with newest Cowboy Andy Dalton. They discuss why he chose Dallas and what he'll remember most about his time in Cincinnati. Find it wherever you get your podcast.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Imbachides, a researcher at ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. We have not confirmed that. Hembo, in your note this morning, you note that with you and Alex Anthopoulos, it's a very Greek podcast today.
It is the most Greek podcast that you could possibly have. I was expecting some moussaka, some souvlaki, potentially. Maybe we'll wash it down with some baklava at the end. Obviously, we're living in a virtual world for that, but that's not possible. But I'm sure the Anthopoulos and the Hembachides would put together a really nice Greek feast.
No kidding. Alex did a great job when we taped with him. Telling stories from 2014, 2015, making the deal for Josh Donaldson, making the deal for David Price, for Troy Tulowitzki, the text message you got from Jose Bautista as this was all going on, that was really cool. I feel like it was a smart decision. I know he paid high prices on these trades, but I felt like it was a smart decision for him to go for it. What'd you think?
Of course it was. And it's easy in hindsight to say it wasn't because, you know, they didn't win a World Series. But reaching the American League Championship Series in consecutive years, given the payroll, given the nature of the division, is an extraordinarily impressive feat buster. And in their second straight year doing so in 2016, 3.4 million fans was the number they drew in attendance, which was their highest total in a season since winning the World Series in 1993. So I don't think you can overstate the impact that it had on the region. And obviously, they sort of galvanized around this team. And to sort of go off on a tangent here, there are a couple things that really strike me about those teams, Buster. First, they were actually the oldest in the American League in both of them. And secondly, less than 40% of the team's production came from homegrown players. You mentioned he took risks. He went out and did things that the average general manager now won't do. It's the kind of thing now that makes a lot of front offices uncomfortable. But it worked for them. And it's very clear that the city embraced that sort of collection of veteran players.
Oh, without a doubt. And think what it meant to meant to the franchise. They became Canada's team again. I remember, watching games when they would go to Seattle and seeing how many Blue Jays fans would make that trip in the aftermath of those deals, and the excitement would go to Seattle to watch that team come over from Vancouver. That was really cool.
That's a really cool thing. And I wanted to just quickly interrupt you because there's a sort of statistical observation I have from these teams that I want to see if you made the same observation and if Alex would have addressed it. So in those two years, Buster, 15 and 16, Blue Jays hitters posted the best strikeout to walk rate in baseball and the lowest chase rate in baseball. And I have to admit, I didn't like watching those teams take at bat because I didn't like the umpire antics and all that stuff. But during those two seasons, Buster, our model says that those Blue Jays teams received a more favorable strike zone than any lineup in baseball, totaling 253 more pitches in their favor than the average team. So I think it's safe to say that the ability of those teams, those lineups, to control the strike zone with their greatest quality, as painful as it was for me to watch, that was sort of like the one sort of nerdy statistical angle that I wanted to go with, because those are the things I actually remember most about those teams.
And Hembo, they drove umpires crazy. I can't say who I talked to, but I've talked to umpires through the years who would like note with a roll of the eye, oh man, that guy is a pain, or that guy's difficult, that sort of thing. But look, you played at a higher level than I did in baseball, and you would acknowledge that typically works. Like, the more complaining you do, generally speaking, you're going to wind up getting the benefit of some calls.
And you see coaches do it in other sports too. It's just like, it's a natural thing for, like, if you're a referee in football and there's a potential penalty call on, you know, like on the side of the field in which, you know, you're closest to that team, you're more likely to throw that penalty. If 40,000 people in the Rogers Center are hounding you because Jose Bautista or Josh Donaldson is ragging you and Gibby's yelling from the dugout, it's only human nature. And over the course of two seasons, Buster, the data show that it worked.
The human element, as they refer to it. All right. Anniversary this week. Kerry Wood's 20 strikeout game. I'll never forget. I watched the end of that game. I was in, it was an afternoon game, of course, in Wrigley Field. And I was in the Yankees clubhouse. I was covering them at the time for the New York Times. And I remember all the Yankee players being locked in on that great Kerry Wood slider down the stretch.
That slider was a Bugs Bunny pitch. The shape of his breaking ball is still one of my favorite pitches ever. But it was on this date, like you said, in only his fifth career start, that Kerry Wood became the first pitcher not named Roger Clemens to record 20 strikeouts in a 9-inning game. Buster, while he did allow that one hit, Wood's game score of 105 is the best mark since earned runs became official in both leagues. That was 1913. Buster, in two strikes, in two strike counts in that game, Astros hitters put three balls in play, fouled off only seven pitches, Jeez. Struck out looking eight times, and struck out swinging 12 times. But allow me just to fast forward to put his career sort of in totality. When he retired in 2012, he did so with the third highest K per nine rate among all pitchers to start at least 100 games. Buster, on that list, he was behind only Randy Johnson and former teammate Mark Pryor. What could have been?
Wow. Yeah, I remember at that time we were thinking, okay, they got Kerry Wood, Mark Pryor. When he joined, he thought that that would be a team that would be making the playoffs every year, kind of like with Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson. And you're right, what could have been. All right, Hembo, thank you.
Later, boys.
Alex Anthopoulos is the general manager of the Atlanta Braves. He was formerly the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. And Alex, thanks for joining us to distract us from what's going on.
Glad to do it.
All right. So you are homeschooling your kids. You're running a baseball team. And so you've got all that going on. And I want to ask you a question about something that I just dealt with and completely botched is, what are you doing about your haircut?
You know, so you know what? I was just when this hit, I had been delaying getting my haircut. I was in spring training and I kept meaning to do it. And I kept putting it off. Then all this hits. So it wasn't like I had already had like a month lead time. I was to the point that I needed a haircut, gave it a few, and then all this hit. A few weeks later, it was just a disaster. I had to do some Zoom calls and stuff for season ticket holders and so on, and it was unbearable. So I went to my wife and I said, I know you've never given a male haircut before, but I need your help. So she basically, I took a clipper I had that I used for my beard and scissors that I have, and you know, I've seen my haircut get cut obviously a million times. I don't know how to do it, but I just kind of walked her through it. I'm like, this, they normally do this, they normally do that. She did it, and she pretty much pulled it off, that it looks fine.
I'm so jealous because my wife is not a nice person. She left it in my hands and I'm telling you right now, it is an absolute disaster. So I will.
Oh, you know what? Well, we actually did it with our son who's seven. We just went, we did the army cut. We took the clipper and we went down to a two and we called it the Corona cut. So it was, it looks like a bowling ball. And when he did his Zoom calls with his classes and his teachers, they all kind of were in shock initially, but I think everyone's kind of come around to it.
You have to send me a picture because I might have to aspire for something like your son has apparently.
That's right.
On where I am. I wanted to bring on to talk to you, in our storytelling mode recently, we've talked to so many general managers about big deals that they made. In 2014, you guys finished 83-79. And that November, you began to make big moves that would eventually lead to the Blue Jays getting in the playoffs for the first time in more than two decades. So just to put this in context, I mean, you are someone who you grew up in Canada. So you knew the Expos, you knew the Blue Jays, you knew the history of baseball in Canada, and you knew the impact on attendance after the players' strike in 94-95, and you knew what it would mean to fans to actually get to the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, it was there's a lot. I mean, just like you mentioned, I grew up in Montreal, played sports, obviously didn't play pro ball. I liked all sports, and I really grew really fond of the Expos and had a deep affinity for baseball. Once Felipe Alou came on board and the team started winning, you know, prior to that, the club had been competitive and they had some good runs, but I didn't really get into it a lot until that time. And that's when I really just got the bug, started going to games, you know, buying Bill James books and so on. But really 1992 is when it started for me, and that the franchise had been, I was born in 1977. So, I was just a casual fan of baseball. Obviously, I played, but it wasn't the same. And it just goes to show you what a winning club can do and the interest level that it creates. So, you know, and I remember because they weren't on TV that often, you know, the sense of pride you had when you had a good team and a winning team that represented a community. I remember they were on This Week in Baseball, which was an unbelievable show for, I know I'm dating myself, but something that I look forward to each week. And for the Expos to be on This Week in Baseball, there was a big feature about them. I remember I taped it on the VHS and I was so proud. It's almost like they had made it. So, you know, from that standpoint, that definitely shaped a lot of what was going on. And then obviously after the strike, having to dismantle that club. And even, you know, when I went to Toronto after and JP Ricciardi was the GM and just talking about being a fan of the Expos. And I remember telling him, I remember where I was when Delino DeShields was traded for Pedro Martinez. And I was crushed as a fan. I loved Delino DeShields. And he'd always joke and tell people, do you know where you were when Delino DeShields was traded for Pedro Martinez? So, you know, being a sports fan is great. And the passion and what it does to a community, it's really hard to quantify.
So how hard was that for you to see? Because, I mean, you could make an argument that the Expos were the best team in baseball when the 94 strike started. The World Series is called off. The next spring, they let Larry Walker go. They trade John Wetland. And within a couple of years, they trade Pedro Martinez. As a fan, how difficult was that for you?
You know, it was difficult, but it was just expected. It was the narrative around the club. And obviously the 94 team, you look back and you wonder and you see the shows on, you know, now you look at what happened with Seattle and Minnesota and other places that had gotten ballparks built. And I do believe if a ballpark had gotten built, things obviously could have changed. And I do think if that 94 season had played out, I remember getting the job with the Braves and I watched a lot of Braves games growing up. Like I said, in Montreal, the Expos were not on TV very much. I watched more Braves than I did Blue Jays just because it was ALNL and we had TBS at home. But I remember after I'd gotten the Braves job, and I didn't know John Schurrle very well at all. When I'd come in and interview with the Braves, I'd, you know, met with him there, but I didn't have a relationship with him. And then I get the job and I go to the GM meetings and he had come out and we started talking about the 1994 Expos team that, believe, you know, at the time we're 74-40 and we're six games up on the Braves. And, you know, we were kind of debating whether the Braves would have caught the Expos. And of course he felt strongly that they would, which is what makes them a Hall of Fame executive. And they won 14 divisions in a row. But then obviously I grabbed guys like Bobby Cox, Chipper Jones, and they even acknowledged that, you know, they didn't think that the Braves were going to come back that year because the Expos were that good a club. So, you know, I would have loved to have seen, you know, there's a lot of, you look back, what if, and so on. But I think everyone knew coming out of the strike, I was just prepared for it.
So let's fast forward. You're general manager of the Blue Jays. As I mentioned, you guys finished 83-79 in 2014. And on November 28, 2014, you make a huge deal with the Oakland Athletics, a deal I know that shocked people with other teams for Josh Donaldson. The perception among other teams was Donaldson was not available. How did that deal come together?
Obviously, the A's had gotten to the playoffs, and I talked to Billy Beane after the offseason, and he had been contemplating making some changes. They constantly have to churn, and you know, he's won as a GM, and they've won more than anybody, and I've done it on – he's done more with less than probably anybody in the game. So at that point, there was talk of you know, guys like – Donaldson, Kazmir, obviously Donaldson had 4 years of control and Billy wasn't shopping him, wasn't making him available. But at the same time, if you looked at his track record in the past, you know, I think if he felt that the deal was there and with their challenges of re-signing players with their market and so on, and Donaldson was going to become an expensive player in arbitration. So he didn't have any interest in trading him. He was going to trade guys with fewer years of control, and we just continue to talk about it and to go through it. And, you know, it was one of those things that we had Brett Laurie, who was a really talented young player, but just couldn't stay on the field. And, you know, I remember early on in my GM career, I never looked at the game's play column. I was focused on, you know, things like walks and strikeouts, on-base percentage, and all those kind of things, and innings pitched. And I didn't worry about innings pitched in games started on the mound either. So I just didn't appreciate and value durability. I just looked at when you're out there, how productive of a player are you. And, you know, we looked to remake the roster 2014 at the trade deadline. I think we were a game up on the wild card or a game behind. We didn't have any funds to add in season. We were trying to make deals to add players, but I basically needed clubs to add to pay for the full salaries. And we had a lot of challenges doing that, but we really blew an opportunity to get to the playoffs then in 2014. And I think just overall the makeup of the clubhouse, we had talented clubs, but something was lacking. It had been 5 years of just getting close. And that 2014 team was good, but guys were getting hurt and they weren't staying on the field. So getting guys like Donaldson, Martin, training for guys like Estrada and so on was really key for us. But the Josh Donaldson deal, when that was going on, we never thought we were going to get an MVP. We thought we were getting a really good player, great defender, durable. That games played column was almost 160 games a year. And, you know, Brett Laurie had been to the point that we just had to constantly replace him in season. So we went back and forth on some of the names. We finally agreed to a package, but I can tell you, we were not high-fiving in the office or anything like that at all. It was one of those deals that was, you know, we were giving up a lot of good young players that we really liked, but we felt we needed to do it. And the fact that we had 4 years with Josh Donaldson, years of control, was pretty important to us. So the deal got done. I remember I was at a Raptors game with my family. Deal wasn't supposed to, it was on a Friday night. Deal wasn't supposed to get announced until, or done till Saturday. The doctors were reviewing it. All of a sudden I get word, getting close to halftime of the game, that it looks like both players are going to pass. And I knew the minute players pass, you know, all the files have been reviewed and so on. At that point, things start to leak. So I told my wife, we better leave. I do not want to be in this arena when a big trade like this, you know, does break. So we left the game, drove home. And that was when I remember having to call Brett Laurie on my drive home to tell him he had gotten traded. And that was a tough day for him. But, you know, it basically broke that night.
And I'm guessing, though, that deal really, I think, for fans in Toronto sort of signaled a crossroad. Like, okay, we're going for it, which had not necessarily been their experience.
Yeah, I mean, we went into that offseason targeting Russell Martin as, you know, the guy we had to have. We just felt like that position, gamer, leader, winner, we really wanted to upgrade that position, thought that he was going to bring a lot. I remember, you know, the minute we could talk to him, you know, called his agent. I think we were the first team in the door to finally sit down and meet with him. We had gone to do a press conference in Montreal at some point in the off season to announce our spring training games. And the Montreal Canadiens were playing that night. And I knew he was a big fan of the Canadiens. And we had arranged to get a suite at the Canadiens game. And we actually privately met with him there and met with him before the game, probably about from 5 to 6:30 or so in the suite, let him ask questions. We could give our pitch. And then after we were going to leave and let him just enjoy the game and so on. But I remember telling him right then and there, we're going to sign you. And I knew obviously that the Cubs had interest and the LA Dodgers had interest, and that was challenging. But I thought, one, being the only Canadian club, if we don't have an advantage being the only Canadian club, something's wrong. The fact that his father could come see him play. Two, you know, we were a good club, and you know, we had won the 83 games prior, and we really faded at the end, and we were at least a wild card team right at the trade deadline, and we weren't able to add at that point. But we had gone out that offseason to just change the makeup of the club, the mix of the club, to get gritty, to get tough. And I remember just having conversations internally and with some players that for one offseason, at least as a GM, I was going to really make an attempt to get a certain type of player and not take any shortcuts and not go after guys that maybe were talented but didn't have some of the qualities that we wanted. And every transaction that we made was geared around getting a certain type of player that offseason. And, you know, the mix of our clubhouse going into 2015 was unbelievable. And even at the trade deadline, again, I think we were a game out of the wild card spot in 2015. Our run differential was through the roof. And a big part of it was we weren't winning as many games as we should have. Our defense wasn't strong. But our clubhouse, and I think we had so many things that when our clubhouse was very strong. And obviously we were very talented as well. But I do think there was a different mentality, a different mindset with how we went into that offseason, and it was getting guys like Martin, Donaldson, and so on.
And the next July, you mentioned 2015, you make a deal for Troy Tulowitzki, a big trade, and then a couple days later, David Price. How did that deal come together with Dave Dombrowski?
Yeah, so that was, I've been calling Dave Dombrowski. So we had been, the guys that were on the trade market in terms of starters, we wanted to add a starter. Scott Kazmir was available. Johnny Cueto was available. Those guys were clearly free. They were going to be free agents at the end of the year. They were both available in trade. We knew those guys were going to get moved. The more work we did on them for our club and our circumstances and so on, and what the asks were from our club for both clubs, we just were uncomfortable doing those deals. And we were still trying to manage, obviously, the long term as well. You're always looking at short and long term. So 2015, we had just signed Russ Martin to a 5-year deal going into the 2015 season. We just traded for Josh Donaldson for 4 years, who we had for 4 years. We had Jose Bautista, I believe, for 2 more years. We had Encarnacion for 2 more years. And there's a lot of scenarios that we were going to keep those guys. So we were still trying to win in 15, but also stay competitive. But knowing that the Tigers were teetering, there were a lot of reports whether they would sell or stay and so on. We just said we're not going to force a deal. We want to make sure that we go out and get the right players. And Cueto and Kazmir, for various reasons, whether it was acquisition costs or just not totally comfortable with what we felt they would mean to our clubs, we didn't really pursue those guys. We got a price, but they weren't guys we were just going to make a push. And David Price, if he was going to be available, was going to be someone that we were going to really step up because we felt very confident in his performance. We were getting a true one. We felt good about his health, all the reports about him as a teammate and so on. So stayed close to Dave Dombrowski, and he said, look, I need to continue to wait. And I think there was a lot of reports about they were waiting on certain series. And then finally, that last week, I believe Dave called me on the Monday or Tuesday and said, I've gotten clearance to go ahead and trade Price. I'd called him the week before and he said, we're not ready. And he wouldn't commit to it. Once he told me he was ready to trade him, and it may have been on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And obviously the trade deadline was on the Friday. I'd say within 48 hours, we got a deal done. So he told me, I'm going to move him, get your stuff together. I'm flying. They were going on the road. I think maybe they're playing the Orioles because I'll call you from my hotel tonight. He called me from his hotel. We talked on the phone at maybe 8 or 9 at night. I think I was on my way home. Maybe it had been an off day for us. We started to negotiate back and forth. He gave me a proposal that was high, but I felt like it wasn't totally out of the realm. And I said, you know what? I'm going to turn around and go back to the office. So I turned my car around, went back to the office, stayed there till about 2 a.m., maybe 3, got the deal done. We finally agreed and we said, look, he said he had to talk to his owner in the morning. I had to do the same thing. My family was gone at the time. My wife is Portuguese, and she would go see her family in the month of July. It was a good setup because of the trade deadline, and I was going to be at work so often. So I was by myself, and I was so wired at that point, knowing we were basically had agreed to a big deal, and I knew I was waiting to talk to our CEO at the time, who was my boss. The person that I reported to get sign off on the deal, I couldn't sleep. So I used to go to different Portuguese bakeries to get coffees and so on around the city, just because everyone, when you work in the front office in Toronto, no matter what sport, all the fans know who you are. So probably about 45 minutes north of the city, there was a little Portuguese bakery that is basically open from 3 or 4 in the morning. So I was probably there at 5 or 6 a.m. and had some coffees and so on, and just kind of waited and tried to kill time. And then by about 7 a.m. I finally called our CEO, told him about the deal. He had signed off on it, and the big issue with the deal was going to be Daniel Norris had gone through a medical procedure earlier in the year, and there was a little bit of uncertainty there of getting that done and how the Detroit doctors were going to feel about that. And obviously he recovered, and we felt confident he was going to recover. So I finally called Dave probably around 8 or 8:30 and told him, I've gotten clearance. Let's start going through the files. He had done the same thing. And then at that point, I couldn't go into the office. I didn't want to be around anybody. I just was really anxious and wanted to know the deal was going to get done. So I drove off that morning close to the office. There's a an area where they kind of have a park and a beach close to the stadium. And I just kind of went over there and I would pace back and forth and sit on a bench and just wait for Dave to give me a call back to tell me that the deal was good to go. And I think by about 10:30 in the morning, maybe 11 a.m., he called me and said that the deal was going through. At that point, I could just breathe a sigh of relief, get back to the stadium, get back to work, because we still had another day, I think, a trade deadline. And obviously, you know, at that point, the deal broke. And I remember getting a text from Jose Bautista. The only thing it said was, "Is it true?" And, you know, that you could tell that the entire team and you know, everybody in the clubhouse was really excited. I think a lot of players had said that's when they really felt like we had a real chance to win.
So you killed a couple hours walking around in a park waiting for that final.
Yeah, I mean, there's an area down, you know, you've been to the stadium with the Rogers Center. It's along the water. It's really close to the water, so you can drive down. It's called Cherry Beach.
Yeah.
It's basically a park, but there's, you know, the lake there and so on. And I knew it was going to be quiet. No one was going to be around. And I just, it would have been very hard to be in the office. And you just get, when you're getting close to a deal and you're waiting, it feels like the wait is really long. And we still had other things to get done. We were still working on a deal with Seattle for Mark Lowe, and we were trying to get Jay Happ in that deal, but Seattle needed salary relief. And at that point, the money that we had saved for trade deadline, we had used all $7 million of our money on Price. So, you know, we still had some other deals. And I think we did the Ben Revere deal on the Friday as well. So we still had some other moves we wanted to make, and we were trying to get done. But you get so locked into that one deal, and you knew how important it was going to be. But that really, obviously, you know, that deal in itself. And I would say more than anything, just becoming a better defensive club and adding Tulo at that point solidified the defense. He didn't make an error the remainder of the year. He led our team in RBI in the playoffs. He came up with some huge hits. And all of a sudden, everybody in the rotation got better when our defense got better. Ben Revere was in left. I mean, we were running out Chris Colabello and Danny Valencia a lot in the corners, of, you know, the corner outfield. Reyes was at shortstop. And even though we were scoring a ton of runs, our run differential was through the roof. We were losing a lot of tight one-run games. It's because we just weren't making the plays defensively. Once we shored that up, that's why I think we really exploded the last 2 months. And it's really, in my mind, where we should have been the entire time.
So in 2010, the Blue Jays averaged about 15,000 people per game in attendance. They ranked 12th out of 14 teams in the American League. After you make those deals, and even before that, your attendance spikes big, and you finished fourth that year in attendance, 34,505. 2016, you finished first in attendance in the American League. You make the playoffs in 2015, and then you have this incredible moment in Toronto, Jose Bautista at the plate in the division series. Give a listen to this. Alex, that sound from Fox, of course. Again, to put it in the context that you, having grown up a baseball fan, watching the crowds down the stretch, seeing your ballpark filled every night, experiencing that moment, what was that like for you?
Yeah, even when you play, I mean, I've seen the clip a million times, and I was there, and I still get the chills when I hear it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things that go on. So, you know, when you think about sports, obviously, and we're all here to win. And but with the things that you like, we're going to talk about that forever. That'll be played forever, and that's a Toronto sporting moment that'll live forever. And that's what it's about to me. And I remember just getting to the Blue Jays. 2004 season was my first season as a scouting coordinator, and just seeing great players like Roy Halladay or Carlos Delgado. And I mean, those guys, obviously Roy Halladay is a Hall of Famer. I think Carlos Delgado should be a Hall of Famer. Certainly shouldn't have gone off the ballot so fast. As great a player as Carlos Delgado was, and you look at the home run totals and the on-base percentages and so on, the highlight of his Blue Jays career, through no fault of his own, was his 4 home run game. That's all you have to point to. And Roy Halladay, it's winning the Cy Young. And you look at guys like Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Bautista, first thing that comes to mind, Encarnacion hits a walk-off in the 2016 wildcard game, Jose Bautista with the bat flip. And it's those iconic playoff moments. And you look at Roy Halladay going to Philadelphia. Those playoff moments are what you remember, and that's what it's about. And I just remember thinking, wow, you know, I don't mean this to be critical in any way, but and again, there was a lot of complications with the AL East payroll and so on at the time. But you know, when I look at did the Toronto Blue Jays get to maximize Carlos Delgado's career in a Blue Jays uniform or Roy Halladay's career in a Blue Jays uniform? And those players are so hard to come by, and now, we lucked into Jose Bautista becoming who he became with the swing changes. We lucked into Edwin Encarnacion becoming who he became. He wasn't the key part of the Scott Rolen deal. Zach Stewart was. And to get players like that and to have them, and then ultimately to get, you know, sign Martin as a free agent or get Donaldson, to not give that team an opportunity, to not take advantage to have those guys get to the postseason, to me, as a GM, you owe it to the city, you owe it to the community, you owe it to the fan base, you owe it to the clubhouse, to take advantage of that. And those are memories that we will, you know, cherish forever. Sports fans across the United States, Canada, and so on will cherish that forever. And that's what sports are about. So, you know, and I look at, you know, I became a baseball fan because there was a contending team. Had the Expos not hired Felipe Alou and become a good club, I wouldn't have gotten the bug and become the baseball fan that I became and ultimately end up being able to work in the sport. And I look at, there's a lot of fans I'd met over the years that had told me that those World Series teams in Toronto, really what, you know, brought them to the stadium and had them fall in love with the team. And I know that those playoff teams in 2015, 2016, and so on had that impact as well. And it has an impact for years to come. So I don't think you ever lose sight of that. And I still, to this day, I think about if you have those rare players that are hard to draft, hard to sign, hard to trade for, you need to do everything you can to take advantage of having those players in their prime.
One last quick follow. When you saw Jose Bautista after that game, after that home run and that bat flip, when you saw him face to face, you know, he's the person who texts you, is it true? What did he say to you? What did you guys say?
I mean, it was just, you know, at the time that game, the bat flip wasn't being talked about. I think the first right. thing I mentioned to him about was the bat flip overall. It was incredible. And I remember when that whole inning went down. So I remember when Russ Martin tries to throw the ball back and he hits Shin Soo Chu's hand and the run comes in and we're down 3-2. And I remember telling somebody, you know what, I just thought we were going to lose. And I just said, wow, what a way to lose. What a terrible way to lose. And I remember someone telling me, look, we're not going to lose. And, you know, you obviously just figuring someone's trying to be nice, but I'm just like thinking the whole time, I was totally preparing myself for the loss. Like, I can't believe this is how we're going to lose this game. And when the home run was hit, we see executives and in boxes and suites and so on during games. I mean, it was just total euphoria in our box. And I think, you know, one of our AGMs at the time was sitting down. I was standing behind him. I think I kind of wrapped my arms around him, but it kind of got right under his chin, and I basically lifted him off of his chair by his neck, and it was just, we were so excited and yelling and screaming, and I'm so glad that the cameras did not get me at that point. But I just remember going down to the clubhouse, and it was obviously crazy and so on, but just talking to him about the bat flip, and you know, the whole thing was just an incredible night, day. I remember after going to the grounds crew guys on the field, and I wanted them, you know, those guys have been grinding with us the entire year. They love the team. Wanted to celebrate with them too, you know, to make them feel a part of it, because they were the ones that, you know, are putting in the hours. And I know it meant the same to them as it meant to everybody in the front office and the players as well. So, you know, when you win, you do it collectively as a group. You don't know what it feels like until you live through it. But it's something that you want to experience year in and year out.
Alex, thanks for the stories and thanks for the insight on the haircut. I got to work on that.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Anytime.
Here's Tim Kirchen's Daily Baseball Fix about Willie Mays.
This date in 1931, Willie Mays was born. When he came to the big leagues in 1951, he quickly became the greatest combination of speed, power, and defense that the game has ever seen, and I believe he remains exactly that almost 70 years later. Lon Simmons, Giants broadcaster, once said Mays was so good that fans came to the park every night expecting a miracle, and he gave them a miracle every other night. When Mays retired in 1973, he was third all-time in home runs and in the top 30 all-time in stolen bases. He won 12 gold gloves, most ever for a center fielder and most ever for anyone in the 500 home run club. He played in 24 All-Star games. Walter Alston, the All-Star game manager, several times told him, "Willie, you know these guys better than I do. You make out the lineup card." So Mays said, "So I hit myself leadoff, and then Roberto got me over, and Hank got me in." And yet Mays didn't even need help sometimes. In the 1965 All-Star game, he hit a home run to start the game. Classic Willie Mays.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Aaron San Diego, excuse me. Cause he has his handle like that. And whenever I see right. him come up on my feed, I just think Aaron. So, there you go. He writes in with so many possibilities for alterations in the season and or playoffs. If you could do something to alter the normal regular season or playoff format, what would it be and why?
You know, it's a great question. My own minimum would be, it'd be cool to have like a 60-game season and then a postseason tournament that would involve more teams, you know, say 16 teams or something like that, because to account for the fact that regular season isn't going to be as long. But the fact is that every day the context changes for the sport and what's possible. And so we won't really know until we actually get a sort of a loose date on when they might be able to start. About what's possible. I just want baseball back in whatever form it is, as long as people can stay healthy.
Absolutely. I'm in lockstep with you there, Buster. Shorten the regular season, expand the postseason by both teams and games. Yep. It just, the regular season goes on forever and it's virtually meaningless at times. So Jordan Michael at Live Free or Die 603 writes in, "I spent 2015 in Korea, went to games often. I was shocked at the experience. Cheerleaders, songs sang by the crowd for players or situations, and an exciting product. That all sounds like lots of fun, but he wants to know, do you think this will exposure will lead to more players getting signed by Major League Baseball clubs?"
I do, because there are going to be more eyeballs on these guys, right? I mean, there are going to be a bunch of baseball scouts getting up these days or watching in the afternoon. We have replays of all these games from the KBO. People are going to be watching these players, and they're going to be going, Now, there is obviously a lot of awareness of players already, but I just think there's going to be more focus on them. And it wouldn't shock me if in 2 or 3 years you were to say, boy, the number of players from South Korea has spiked.
Last one up, Eric Sorensen at Coach Sorensen 9 writes in, "If you could go back and experience any Hall of Fame weekend, what weekend would you go back to?"
I would go back the weekend that Ted Williams was inducted. You know, to me, he's one of the most unique characters in baseball history. He was incredibly opinionated. He was incredibly strong-willed. I mean, he did definitely remind you of John Wayne in terms of, you know, how big he was and the way that he spoke, and he would take over any room, take over any conversation. So when he talked about, you know, the hope that at some point that there would be African-Americans in positions of leadership, you know, managing in his Hall of Fame speech, I thought that was pretty cool. I would love to have gone back and been in that moment.
That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Lots of great questions coming in. Really appreciate that from the listeners.
All right. That's it for today. My thanks to Alex and to Hembo and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and don't cut your own hair.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight. The podcast.